Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hi, everyone. It's Steven Schleicher with a little behind-the-scenes talk when it comes to podcasting. The top of the show, this part that you're listening to right now, is extremely valuable space for advertisers. And here at Major Spoilers Entertainment, we get a lot of requests from advertisers to use this space to talk about erectile dysfunction. Now, I know you don't want to hear me talk about boners. You don't want to hear Matthew talk about boners. You don't want to hear Rodrigo talk about boners. And I know you don't want Ashley to talk about boners as is. And that's why when an advertiser comes to us with a pitch about boner pills, we say, no, thank you. Because we know our listeners are the kind of people that only want to hear about how many boners the Joker can make or Mike Seaver's best friend, Richard Milhouse Stabone, a.k.a. Boner. We can say no to boners because of our patrons. Our patrons who support our work at patreon.com/majorspoilers. And thanks to patrons like Crystal, Nate, and Mark, and Marshall, and J. Michael T., and our newest patron, Nicholas, we don't have to burden you each and every week with advertisements for products that you don't need. And we can continue to keep this podcast free from boner pill talk when you double-click a pledge level at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Just a couple of bucks a month helps defray the cost of this and every podcast we produce at Major Spoilers, as well as our website server and equipment costs. And when you join us at patreon.com/majorspoilers, you not only support our work, but you get access to bonus content that will keep you satisfied. And we're constantly pumping new, exclusive content to you each and every week. Now, we can't keep it going without your support. And as the new year draws near, those boner pill advertisers are already starting to circle. So say no to boners in 2021 by joining other listeners like yourself at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, il a tombé Asterix, and the MSP has you covert with the mansions of the gods. We have the latest release dates, the news on what's ending, what's beginning, what's to hope for in 2021, all brought to you in the mighty Major Spoilers manner. We even got the Legion. So sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a podcast trip that started from your playback box and now it's on the air. It's on the air.
Welcome to issue 902 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and checking us out this week. Everybody is here. Everybody is wonderful.
This is the 902 one? Oh.
This is the 902 episode. That is correct.
Good to know.
And why don't we start things off with a little news?
News.
Warner Brothers has announced that Wonder Woman 1984 is coming home for Christmas. For months now, the studio has said Wonder Woman 1984 would release on December 25th, and they weren't wrong. The studio plans on releasing the movie on HBO Max on Christmas Day, but if you're dead set on seeing it in the theaters, you're in luck, because the movie's going to arrive in whatever movie theaters are open on December 16th and December 25th here in the United States.
Both of them.
The best part about this news is HBO Max is not going to charge any additional money for this movie for the first 30 days on the HBO Max service.
I was so excited when I saw this news because I've been waiting for so long for this to happen. And I'm also like completely baffled because to me, this seems like a giant waste of money. And I guess whoever owns Warner is just more concerned about HBO Max subscriptions than...
Yes.
I also think that this heralds that we are not getting a Wonder Woman 3, because what metric is this to be? I don't understand this choice, even though I am excited for this choice.
Sure.
Like, so, I'm completely baffled by this in every possible way.
So Warner Brothers owns, Warner Brothers is owned by AT&T. And over the last couple of months, AT&T, just like Disney, has started to put a big push into their streaming service. Now, unfortunately, HBO Max, from the numbers that I can say see, does not have the subscriber numbers that Disney has. Disney has something like 74 million people subscribed to it. I believe HBO Max only has something like 9 million or something like that. So pushing this Wonder Woman 1984 does give people a chance to subscribe to the service and not have to pay extra. So I'm wondering if this isn't some subtle shade throwing at Disney, who released Mulan and said, on top of your subscription, you're also going to have to pay $30 if you want to see this. Disney, Warner Brothers is saying, if you want to see Wonder Woman 1984, just become an HBO Max subscriber and you can watch it for free for the first 30 days. And then after that, I'm guessing it's also going to go out to the Apples and the other places that you can see it. I wouldn't discount this not getting a sequel. Based on, you know, how many people might end up subscribing to the service. If this blows people out of the water, this could definitely make a lot of money. It's probably not going to make a whole lot of money via streaming services or premium VOD later on, but it is something. And the fact that they're releasing Wonder Woman 1984 worldwide, specifically in China, on December 16th, and then also releasing it here in the United States on December 25th to any theaters that are open, still says that they're trying to appease the theater owners. And of course, it also gives them that that very hopeful Oscar nomination when Oscar time comes around this year.
Yep.
Matthew.
Unfortunately, after that good news, it's bad news for fans of Jefferson Pierce. Black Lightning will conclude its run on the CW at the end of the coming season, according to the CW itself. This is like a week after we reported that they have ordered a backdoor pilot on the character Painkiller, who's been appearing in season 4. Black Lightning, of course, is the story of Jefferson Pierce, played by Cress Williams, who is a high school principal, also a sort of retired superhero who's forced to don his supersuit once again after years of retirement when a gang arises and recruits his star students. The fourth and final season of Black Lightning debuts on February the 8th of 2021.
What do you think there, Ashley?
I am truly crushed, very upset. I think this is the best show on the CW, and I can't believe that they're doing this. However, my hope is that if this is going away, then that means that we're getting, I hope Painkiller is really good. Like, I'm not quite sure why this is happening, because I think it's one of the more successful shows. Mm-hmm. I think it breaks the formula. And honestly, I like having Cress Williams and Damon Gupton in my CW feed because they're two such phenomenal actors. So this just like shocked me completely and utterly. So I really hope that it wasn't done carelessly, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the things that made Black Lightning stand out was the fact that it wasn't part of the Arrowverse, and then they brought it into
the
Arrowverse.
It is, right?
Yeah, and so I think that that's part of the problem. Plus, I think the CW and maybe Warner's has figured out that there's an ebb and a flow to every series. And so, you know, if they want to get that new Wonder Woman or Wonder Girl series that's coming up into play, then somebody's going to have to take a bow. Maybe they're thinking, and especially since this is a Berlanti joint, everything CW is a Berlanti thing these days. Maybe he can only handle so many superhero shows at once. I don't know the reasoning exactly behind this being the final season, but we're also seeing the final season of Supergirl this year. I don't know what's going on with Legends of Tomorrow, if that's going to continue. I'm going to bet that we see another season and maybe season and a half of The Flash before it's gone. And then they're just going to keep cycling other superheroes in, kind of like what we might see happening over at DC Comics in the not too near future if things go this way.
Oh.
Ready, Rigo, you've got the last story this week.
Okay. The Last of Us series adaptation has been officially greenlit at HBO. Based on the video game of the same name, the series follows Joel and Ellie as they make their way out of an oppressive quarantine zone following the fall of modern civilization. Chernobyl creator Craig Mazin is attached to write and executive produce along with Neil Druckmann, the writer and creative director of the game. This is the first television series from PlayStation Productions.
I think this could be kind of interesting. I'm kind of interested in seeing all the the fungus head people running around. That could be quite scary.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because The Last of Us is a series that uses, you know, a zombie apocalypse type thing as a backdrop to then explore the, like, the humanity of its characters. So we'll see. I mean, the creator of the game is tied to it, right?
So we'll see. Yep. Yeah, so I think it should be good. Hey, listen,
I've
everyone.
I've seen pictures of the fungus heads, and I'm out.
Yeah, no, it's you go watch some of the gameplay that people do online, and it is it is scary. Yeah. It is scary. Listeners, you can join the conversation about these stories and more over on our Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, or you can link your Patreon account to Discord and get access to even more features at patreon.com/majorspoilers. With the news out of the way, let us jump into some reviews. And I'm very curious, Rodrigo, this past weekend on the Hulu, we got an Animaniacs reboot.
That's right. The Animaniacs are back. Or at least most of them are, or some of them are. Animaniacs, if you'll recall, was a TV show back in the 90s where they decided to make a show that harkened back to animation from like the 30s and 40s. Sprinkle in some topical references to Bill Clinton and the Goodfellas. Put in a bunch of stuff that kids weren't going to get, but you could poke a little bit at the parents so that they don't immediately become enraged at having to watch such a goofy show, and you've got Animaniacs. So it's a tall order because a lot of people grew up watching Animaniacs, and they're in their 30s now, late 30s maybe, maybe 40s. And it's like, how do you take a show that was such a weird mix like Animaniacs and you update it? And mostly it's by just loading a bunch of lampshades into a machine gun and just like shooting them everywhere, right? The show constantly references the fact that it itself is a reboot, and they make fun of reboots in general and make fun of other shows that have had reboots and kind of get away with it that way most of the time. I feel that first off, most important thing that you should know, they cut out the entirety of the cast except for the Warner Brothers, their sister Dot, and Pinky and the Brain. So if you were like itching for some Bernadette Peters as Rita the Cat, she's not there. Mindy and Button's not there. The Good Feather's not there.
No chicken
Minerva poo? Mink. You have the internet for that now, you perverts.
What about Hello Nurse?
Hello Nurse is not there. Dr. Scratches and shows up once. Ralph the Guard is back. But that's about it. Instead, you don't get... So the idea behind like Slappy Squirrel and all of those is like each of those characters had their own segment of the show. There are now really no non-Warners or Pinky and the Brain segments except for a couple in some of the shows late in the season where it's just kind of a silly symphony or wait, which ones are the Warner Brothers ones? A Merry Melody, you know, something like that. Where the characters, it does have characters, but we're not expecting those characters to come back later. It's just for this episode. That's what this little vignette is. And you know, mostly this show is pretty good. I think there's a few weird missteps for it. There's one episode where I think like they were like, hey, I know what we should do. We should make fun of Kanye. And it just feels weird to have like a very white sounding Yakko like lecture a like Kanye stand-in about like rap. It's like this just feels like really weird. But generally speaking, most of the episodes, it's, you know, the Warners doing wacky things and torturing some random person who is probably a jerk. Then a segment with Pinky and the Brain trying to take over the world. And, you know, the Pinky and the Brain segments are, you know, more so even than the Warner ones are like spot on because the Pinky and the Brain formula is so set, right? Mm-hmm. Even more so than the other characters. Pinky and the Brain just has this like airtight formula. You just play it every time. If you like mess with the formula a little bit, it's kind of fun. But you could just keep showing Pinky and the Brain episodes just with like slightly different ingredients. I mean, Pinky and the Brain had their own show for a while. It's like that you don't like Pinky and the Brain is like the tightest thing about the show. I really hate all of the supporting cast because I really hate the way that all the characters are drawn. Rather than if you think about, you know, your Dr. Scratch's Niv, your Thaddeus Plot, your Ralph the Guard, you know, all of these secondary human characters, they were drawn in kind of that 90s, you know, Animaniacs Tiny Toon style. Mm-hmm. They're round, they're cute, they look like, you know, they look like Warner Brothers cartoons. These guys are very angular, very weird. They have kind of like this Crick Falusi vibe to them. It's and like they're ugly. These characters are like actively ugly. And there are episodes in which there's like multiple of these characters or some of these characters are whatever or whoever the Warners are messing with, and they are very central. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to keep looking at this character. But mostly I'm willing to overlook it. I was not expecting these to be as good as they are. I really got some like solid chuckles out of some of these episodes. My wife was briefly awake while I was watching one of them. She watched one segment that had a song in it, and she was like, that was cute. So that's already way better than I expected. I'm going to give it 4 slices of meatloaf. If you have Hulu, check it out. Should you get Hulu to watch the new Animaniacs reboot? Well, if you were a big Animaniacs fan, I would say there's something in here for you, right? It's like 15 episodes, which is maybe more episodes than any given season of Animaniacs. Actually, Animaniacs probably was like a 22 episode thing, but it's lots of Animaniacs content, most of which is going to be pretty similar to what you remember.
So I'm curious, you did mention that there's music. Are they great songs again, like Countries of the World or anything like that?
No, although they reference that a lot. They reference how like catchy and well-known their songs are.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they get through so much stuff just with lampshades, right?
Yeah.
There is a song. There's an episode that is set in Russia where there's like a bootleg Animaniacs from Russia, and they do all of the countries that Russia has tried to annex or that are like, you know, that should be part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So they do that, you know, and it's a reference to the Countries of the World song.
Interesting. Now I'm also curious. It sounds like they dropped the entire season at once, which is something that Hulu isn't typically known for.
Yeah. Yeah, you can watch all episodes right now, and I think it came down a few days before this recording, like maybe 4 days. So
yeah,
they just put it all at once, or put it in a couple chunks, and yeah, it's all there for you to watch. I binged it in a couple days.
The other thing is about the angular animation, and I have only seen the character drawings on this, but you've watched the new DuckTales, and to me, DuckTales is very angular as well.
Yeah.
And even that new Mickey Mouse cartoon is super angular to where people are like, what is this stuff?
Yeah. So there's definitely, we're definitely living in this post Ren and Stimpy, post SpongeBob world, where that is like a viable animation style. And I would not put DuckTales in this. I think DuckTales style is a post Homestar Runner style.
Mm, okay.
And I think Animaniacs and that Mickey Mouse shorts show, right?
The
one where like they like their faces are back to like black and white. They look like mm-hmm. the old school ones, but they're like really exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the Animaniacs is like, it doesn't look the same, but when you look at the animation, when you look at the exaggeration, when characters squash and stretch and the sort of like kind of like mildly gross out stuff that happens, those two are actually very similar. And it's, you know, again, I feel like that is this trend that like SpongeBob like really solidified after like Ren and Stimpy and a couple other shows were trying it out.
Okay, very cool. I might have to check that out. Although when you don't have the supporting cast, it sounds like both Matthew and I are disappointed that Chicken Boo is not here. Maybe I may have to give it a pass.
There's an episode where you find out what happened to everyone in the supporting cast. So there's at least that.
Okay. All right.
Everybody sort of makes a cameo.
Okay. Wait, were Buttons and Mindy thrown into a chipper shredder? Because I'll definitely watch.
Well, it's not good what happens to them. So
there you go. I'm totally on board.
All right, Matthew, tell us about Legion of Superheroes number 11 out this week from DC Comics.
Legion of Superheroes number 11 is, the best way to describe it is it's part three of a part five series where even though I read issue 10, I didn't read part one and two of this story. So yeah, that's a little weird. This story, well, each issue of Legion starts with narration from a Legionnaire. This month's narration is Mon-El. And we do find out explicitly that Mon-El is in fact the descendant of Superboy John Kent, but also the descendant of General Zod. General Zod is the grandfather of Mon-El's
children. So he's Kon-El?
I don't know. But Mon-El has several children on New Krypton, and Mon-El has gotten very upset and flown away, and the words giant baby drama baby man are actually thrown about, which, again, you know, Bendis dialogue. Sometimes you get moments like that. But this issue is mostly explosions. The Legion is in three different places, none of which seem to be where they were last issue. Again, there are moments where people are looking for Mordru. So Saturn Girl and Superboy and Dr. Fate, who's a Legionnaire now, are looking for Mordru, while Ultra Boy is trying to take over his home planet. We get bits with Triplicate Girl. There's a lot of characters in the Legion. And normally I'm kind of okay with that. But there's also a lot of villains in this issue. Because not only do we have Mordru in play, not only do we have Jonah trying to fight literally the ruling class of his whole planet, we have Rogal Zaar. I don't like Rogal Zaar. I freely admit that. Rogal Zaar is, to me, just a subpar attempt to make Doomsday again. So having Rogal Zaar show up and be this incredible, unstoppable force who knocks out two-thirds of the Legion, including Wildfire, in one panel, kind of bothers me. But, again, that's my biases talking. Wildfire should be tougher than that, you people. Listen to me, Wildfire is tougher than that. But you have the big real villains. They're doing their pew, pew, pew throughout the universe. We do get a couple of reveal moments. We get a little bit more digging into the origins of Gold Lantern. Again, it doesn't necessarily follow from what we got last issue, which is very troublesome to me because this really does feel like I missed an issue. But I know I didn't. I haven't missed an issue of Legion, and that's what's frustrating. So, as this issue ends, pew pew, explosions, oh my god, everyone's in huge trouble, Rogal Zaar is here, is Superboy going to die, dun dun dun. Issue 12, next issue, is naturally an endpoint of the six-issue arcs that are necessitated by modern reprinting strategies, which means that regardless of what happened here in issue 10 or issue 9, 12 is going to be concluding this particular arc. I hope it does well. It does. I want to see this arc do well. I want to see the Legion, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, survive. I want to see more Legion. This issue is, I don't know how to describe it because I liked previous issues that were written by Bendis and drawn by Soken von Graubatcher. I really enjoyed.
Wait, is that the real name?
Yes.
Outstanding.
Ryan Sook and Wade von Graubatcher.
Amazing.
And so I'm looking at this book and I'm like, why do I not like how Ultra Boy looks? Why do I not like how Superboy and Saturn Girl look in the dark? Why am I annoyed at endless Bendis back and forth dialogues that we've seen before? Oh, by the way, Rose Forest appears in this issue for the first time in like four issues. And even though she hasn't been Rose and Thorn in the entirety of the new 30th century, guess who shows up? I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with Spawn.
Batman.
It's Batman.
Spawn shows up in this issue? That's crazy.
Spawn only rhymes with Spawn if you're from Boston. And I happen to know that you are from Central Kansas, Mr. Man.
I'm just representing Boston this week. Hello, Bostonites.
Look, Steven with a Boston accent, I'm very here for.
Yeah, Steven's from Southie.
How do you like them apples? See? Anyway, Matthew,
Park
what's...
the card at Fort Hays State University.
It really turned Australian there for me at the end.
Yeah, you kind of went a little bit...
Not enough how you like them apples, too much shrimp on the Barbie.
You went a little Buckaroo Banzai.
So where does this go, Matthew?
Crocodile Dundee, whichever it was. Anyway, three slices of meatloaf for Legion of Superheroes number 11. Still an okay read, still a book that I would recommend to Legion fans, although I'm going to be honest with you, the new romances are bugging me. Phantom Girl is not dating Ultra Boy, she's dating Mon-El, but that's okay because Lightning Lad seems to be single and Saturn Girl is dating Superboy. And in this issue, we get a moment where Shadow Lass is confused and we have some flirtation times where people are like, hey, Ultra Boy, you sure are super cute. And I'm like, okay, Dawnstar, that's not right. Don't do that. Don't even do that. So as long as you are able to come to this and look at it and say, I know the limitations of a Brian Bendis joint. I know the fact that this is not the Legion that my grandfather saw or that my uncle saw or that my third cousin Elwood used to read about. Then, yeah, three slices of meatloaf. Not a bad book. Not a great book. A very frustrating book for me.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. Let's go from DC Comics over to Dynamite Entertainment. And Ashley, I don't know if we've done a lot of Game of Thrones comic book reviews either on the podcast or over at the Major Spoilers website.
Well, then I'm happy to break the curse and do more.
Hooray! Yeah,
I would touch a Game of Thrones review with a 10-foot pole.
Have I mentioned, by the way, that I'm a professional writer who has a book coming out tomorrow? Please buy it. Jupiter Dread, the Forgotten Radio. Not from Dynamite. But you know, I reviewed the whole last season of Game of Thrones, and I'm one of the people who doesn't hate the finale because it makes complete sense if you know anything about character structure. So I'm happy to take on more Game of Thrones reviews. You can follow me at Ashley V. Robinson. If you want to argue with me, at least have the decency to follow me. This is telling, or retelling, depending on how you want to frame it, is adapting George R.R. Martin's second installment in the Game of Thrones oeuvre called A Clash of Kings, which is good because I only know that the first one is called Game of Thrones and the second one is called Clash of Kings and the rest of the books are Game of Thrones 3, 4, and 5, and then the one about the Targaryens because I can't keep track of these titles for some reason. What's weird about this is if anyone is familiar with Clash of Kings or Game of Thrones season 2, this is the beginning of Sansa becoming a interesting and dynamic character and really coming into her own and starting in on her arc where she will ultimately become her mother by the end of this. And this is her starting to pull away from the influences of King's Landing and kind of figuring out what is going on around her. This is right dealing heavily with the scene where Cersei basically confronts her being like, you ready to be married to Joffrey? You know what your duties are? Good, because I'm drunk and I might slap you. And it is preceded by a small council meeting, which means that this book is a lot of talking. So it is very fitting that Matthew went before me to talk about the amount of dialogue that Brian Michael Bendis likes to include on the page, because there's a lot of words in this because we've basically stripped away all of George R. R. Martin's wonderful descriptions of trees and reduced this type of storytelling to the dialogue because comics. I think Mel Ruby, who is on the art here, does a really good job at making the characters recognizable. If you are familiar with the shows, like Cersei wears one of the pink gowns that she wears for a couple episodes. The hairstyles are very similar without being too worried about, oh, this is what Lena Headey looks like. This is what Sophie Turner looks like, et cetera, et cetera. So they're recognizable, but as always seems to be brought up when we're doing Buffy and Game of Thrones, Doctor Who comics, likenesses are a thing, and I appreciate that Ruby is not bothering with them too much, so the characters do look the same from panel to panel. However, most of the characters are sitting around pointing aggressively at each other, and even though that serves the story and is absolutely true to what these situations would have been, it's not necessarily the most dynamic type of comic book storytelling, with comic books being a visual medium, much like television and film. So as a Game of Thrones fan and as a comics fan, I thought this was a good read. I dug it. I remembered when I read this the first time. I really liked looking at the art. The backgrounds are really quite good in this. I think Mel Ruby's going to go on to be quite a little superstar. So watch that name. Get in early on the Instagrams. But I don't, you know, I don't know if adapting a large fantasy prose epic is the easiest thing to do when you're coming at it from a comics point of view. I know Dynamite does really well with a lot of their adaptations, and I know a lot of their video game stuff has been super successful and has cracked open the lore of those worlds in a really interesting way. I'm not sure if this does it. So while I dug this, I think if you are not like me sitting at the vestige of Game of Thrones and comic books, I'm not sure if this is going to be for you. So I'm going to give it 3 because I dug it, but no more than 3, especially for issue number 9, because it's definitely not a jumping on point. Like we are months, if not years, deep in the story already in terms of the in-universe story. So you got to know the chess pieces in the Game of Thrones by this point.
All right, cool. Thank you for that, Ashley. Wrapping it up this week, it is Star Wars Adventures number 2 from IDW Publishing. Now, I picked this up for a couple of reasons. Number 1, Ashley did Star Wars Adventures Annual 2020 last week,
yeah.
And she was so excited about it. I was like, man, I need to go check out and see what's going on outside of Vader's castle. So I grabbed this. The other thing that drew me to this is, of course, The Mandalorian, which is on the Disney Plus, and it's got a fantastic season going on. So I'm thinking, oh, I want to read some more stuff set in Star Wars universe. In fact, I'm reading one of the Chuck Wendig prequel, or the prequel to the final.
Life Debt?
No, it is the crap. I don't have them here in front of
That's
me.
That's okay.
It is the I'll find it here by the time we get to the end of this review. But I decided to say, hey, Star Wars Adventures number 2. I'm going to dig this. It'll be a lot of fun. And then I found out it's about Poe and Finn and Rey. And that's not the Star Wars I'm here for at this point. I think the final JJ film kind of put a cap on anything that I wanted to know about the Skywalkers or their extended families or the Palpatines and their extended families. I guess I was kind of done with that. And I was hoping for something a little bit more. But this is the second part of a story where Poe and Finn have taken Rey to a planet to where they've set up an obstacle course for her to do some Jedi training. But surprise, there's all sorts of pirates on this planet. And they get into a lot of pew-pew-pews and fighty-fighty type stuff. And so that's what this issue is, the final big confrontation of Rey trying to get back with Poe and Finn and escape the planet with their little droid BB-8. Oh, by the way, I'm not a big fan of the alternate spellings of the droids. You know, R2-D2 to me is R mm-hmm. with a number 2, a D and the number 2. BB-8 is BB-8 or just BB-8. But apparently, and this is, you know, canon, I guess, there's alternative spellings to that. And in this issue, they go all out on the BEE-BEE-ATE. And
like
I just
people getting paid by the letter.
I guess, man, letterers, I hope you are getting paid quite a bit of money for that, because oof, I'm just not a fan of that spelling. This is fine. It's a fun little adventure. If you've got kids like my kids, especially my youngest, who was all into the final 3 movies. He's a huge Kylo Ren fan, which is a little disturbing. But I think this is something that he would get a kick out of. And obviously it is targeted to YA readers. But this is fun. It's got a lot of action in it. It's got some really great color, some really great art in this. I just think it's well done. It's just, I was hoping for the excitement that Ashley had last week with Star Wars Adventures Annual and how much fun I'm having with Mandalorian. And then
yeah.
I get Poe and Finn and Rey again. And it's just like, well, that's not really what I wanted. Can we get something else besides the Skywalker and the Palpatines, please? Still, 3.5 slices of meatloaf. Enjoyable is what I would say. And if you got kids who are into Star Wars, pick this up for them. They're gonna eat it up. So actually probably pick up the first issue and the second issue, because otherwise you don't have a complete story. So there you go.
Ooh, continuity.
I know, right? Listeners, if you want more reviews, there is one place where you can head, majorspoilers.com, where we've got reviews going up every day of the week. And maybe in the near future, Ashley, I will be talking about the Chuck Wendig, I guess it's the 3-book series, Aftermath.
That
takes
yeah.
place months
I think
after.
Lunch comes Aftermath. It's like Aftermath,
yes.
then lunch, and then
yes.
gym.
Yes.
Whatever comes Aftermath is always a relief because math.
Yeah. The Aftermath series, I guess, takes place like just a couple of months after Return of the Jedi. And when, you know, everything's in a turmoil and the rebels are still doing their rebel things and different adventures and different things. So now I'm reading Aftermath, which features the introduction of what's his name? Cobb Vanth from Mandalorian episode 9.
Cobb Vanth.
Yeah. Vanth from this season's first episode.
And I fully thought you said Kyle Vanth, like some boy I went to high school with.
Yeah. Maybe. Who knows?
You know him as Timothy Oliphant.
Yes, Timothy Oliphant.
Oh, Raylan Givens.
Look at all the Oliphants. Frodo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hobbits.
Oh, you know what, everybody? At this point, I would be talking about our affiliates, and we could have such fine affiliates, like the companies that want to sell you razors to shave, you know, certain parts of your body. But we don't have those kind of affiliates. Because we have fine patrons over at patreon.com/majorspoiler. So if you would like to send us some feedback about anything you've heard on this show, you can certainly drop us a tweet at Major Spoilers or send us an email at podcast@majorspoilers.com. Or you can call the Major Spoilers hotline at 785-727-1939. And we'd be more than happy to listen to you. But because we don't have any affiliates to talk about, let's talk about Asterix and the Mansion of the Gods, album 17. This is something we've been doing every year on Thanksgiving. I will either write a review about Asterix volume over at majorspoilers.com, or as we've done in the last couple of years, and we'll probably continue to do, talk about a volume right here on the Major Spoilers podcast. So this one is Caesar's latest attempt to run the Gauls out of Gaul Town, and he wants to start putting up some apartment complexes. He wants to gentrify the Gauls, which I don't know, when did gentrification become kind of a thing? Because this book came out in what, 72, 73, something like that?
Well, it came out 73 in English. I think the original was 71.
Yeah, so I wonder, was gentrification something that was a deal in the 70s? Because, man, for those people who have seen cities like Atlanta, where I lived for a couple of years and saw gentrification of inner parts of Atlanta start to happen, this was somewhat on point.
I mean, I think you could argue that gentrification started in the early Middle Ages, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Peasants got pushed out of city centers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
If you want to get like real weird and political.
No. I'm sure you're absolutely right. But I just, you know, that is a big kind of talking point for a lot of communities these days. And to open up this book and see, oh, that's exactly what Caesar's trying to do. He figures that once enough Romans move into the neighborhood surrounding our hero's encampment, that either they will be driven out or they will be integrated into, and that will be the end of them. And that's kind of the setup for our story. And of course, Asterix and Obelix and Gitafix and everybody else has a plan to keep them Romans out.
Well, the first that I can find is mid-60s references to gentrification in sociological treatises by Ruth Glass.
Are we pretending that redlining is not gentrification?
No, I think it is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you could say that what Rome did throughout Europe is gentrification in a lot of ways, which makes perfect sense here.
Yeah.
Accidentally, incredibly historically accurate.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how accidental it is. I mean, every time I read an asterisk, I'm always like, asterisk. I can't pronounce it wrong. I just can't.
Sure you can.
I mean, you can certainly mispronounce it wrong.
America, you can do whatever you want.
I was raised by teachers.
Home of the shouty.
The ghost of my grandmother hovers over me. I mean, if I say ain't, I hear a voice going, that's not a word. But yes, asterisks. Stories are always so weirdly nuanced and layered, it makes you wonder exactly what it is that Goscinny, however one pronounces Goscinny, was actually aware of and not aware of, because it feels like this is history.
Well, no, it is. But at the same time, I think that, as Rodrigo was talking about earlier with the Animaniacs, Animaniacs is also layered, where you have to have the silliness of, hey, can we go hunt some boars now? And, you know, the jokes about how bad the local singer is. But then you also are layering it in with jokes that the adults can get as well, right, Rodrigo?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This piece has a lot of, I mean, Asterix itself is a comic based on history, right? So
it would be kind of a poor comic based on history if it wasn't also commenting on that history. And I think that gets kind of watered down as you go a lot of the time. And, you know, Asterix meets like magical creatures and like random people that probably wouldn't have come across a Gaul necessarily. But at its core, it's, you know, people in proto-France trying to keep the rocks. And so I think you're always going to have that powerful in-group that's trying to push an out-group out. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of how politics works. That's how states tend to work. So there's always going to be something that is very relevant about a small group of holdouts that are trying to maintain their culture while a bigger set of people are trying to push them out.
Yeah. Yes. Ashley, have you read any Asterix at all? Are you're familiar with this? I don't remember.
Very familiar. Also familiar with their movies as well. Action movies.
Well, which we don't really get here in the United States because they're all in French, and for some reason that they don't want to bring those here. Although I did love the Asterix and Cleopatra movie. I finally got a copy of through other means. But yes, they are very good. Now, so the next question I have for you is, did you read them in English or did you read them in French?
I've read Asterix in French originally, so Canada tangent. In Canada, we have two levels of kindergarten. You start going to kindergarten when you're four for part D. So we have junior kindergarten and senior kindergarten.
Nice.
And I have a vivid memory of in my junior kindergarten class of all the Asterix comics lined up in the little cubby holes for us.
Nice. Now, were those the English or French?
French, yeah. Original French.
So I'm curious because
I'm sure there was an English one, but I only remember reading them in French.
One of the things
Canadians
that
speak French until they reach the larval state.
One of the things
and
that
we can blossom into Spanish and Italian if we're really lucky.
Yeah. Right.
One of the things I get a kick out of is the namings of everyone. You know, the druid who's always mixing up potions, get a fix. In this case, we get to meet the grand architect of Caesar's plan, square on the hypotenuse. And, you know, I think that stuff works very well in English, and the English translation of this is very good. But I'm wondering, do you recall those names in French working as well as far as puns go?
The hypotenuse is it's literally the same joke. It's just the French pronunciation.
Okay.
And then get a fix in French is panoramix, which is like it literally means like to mix or on a larger scale.
Okay.
Like it's the same joke. It's just in the different language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I didn't know how well they translated back and forth.
They do better here than they do with Tintin, where they're just like making up Anglo names, like where they're not, where they're just Johnson and Thompson and Thompson. I'm sorry. Johnson and Johnson is a family company. They can sponsor major spoilers at any time. I know they got cash.
Fortunately, the French were in control of the British Isles for a long time. So a lot of these words are the same.
Yeah. Obelix is the same.
Or the root is the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you guys think, Rodrigo? What is your big overall take on this this book? As we've talked about Asterix before, but I'm curious about your take on this particular story.
It's interesting because what I found most interesting about this story is that the Gauls were super strong and also like cool, kind of have to let the Romans gentrify their forest because they want to help some slaves and giant asterisk, some terrible depictions of black people in this.
Which is always, I mean, that's always the problem with this is, again, it's one of those things where it's like, okay.
Tintin's even more guilty of that, too.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Different culture and the 70s slamming together, and here for 2020, there's a lot of this stuff that just doesn't fly.
These are 40s era caricatures.
Oh, depictions, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, these are as bad as the stuff that you get, you know, in the parts that they cut out of Fantasia or the episodes of Looney Tunes that they don't air anymore.
So
very rough stuff here, almost or possibly deal breakingly so, depending on who's reading.
Okay. So let me just say this. If you go and look, so Asterix and the Mansions of the Gods has been turned into a movie, an animated movie, And if you go online, and in fact, it's very hard to find images from the comic book. But if you go and look at the images section, you will see how the slaves are depicted in the animated movie. And it's not much better than the comic book.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, also, I'm going to say something with love about a country that I love. France doesn't necessarily have the most woke race relations. And I know I'm saying that as somebody like podcasting from America, but that, you know, we all doing our best.
Yeah, I know. And you know, and that's one
but
of the things
that
Matthew...
you're absolutely not wrong.
No, Matthew and I talk about this a lot on the Legion Clubhouse podcast where, you know, a lot of the topics and a lot of the themes that were acceptable in the 50s, 60s, and 70s totally do not fly today. And I think that it's important for people to recognize this so that if you're sitting there going,
yes,
oh, this sounds like a fun comic book about Romans and Gauls fighting and beating each other up. What a bunch of funny jokes are in here. And then you go and you pick it up because they are collecting the omnibus editions right now. You might go and pick it up for your kid and then open it up and go, oh my, this is not what I was expecting. So just be aware of that. Rodrigo, I'm sorry to interrupt you with that tangent, but please go on.
Oh, sure. So the most interesting thing to me about this is that the Gauls have to sort of allow this to happen in order for the slaves to be set free. And that's really where the story kicks off, right? Once the Romans manage to get a foothold in, they start influencing the way that the Gauls do things and changing their society basically through economic power. And they realize that they're going to have to get them out because they are, in fact, wrecking the society that they have, which again, it's like, I don't know how like purposeful an economics lesson it is. I mean, it makes sense from a like moving the plot along sense, but from a like, yeah, it's like when you gentrify an area and prices shoot up, the people that originally lived there can't afford to live there anymore. That's how you gentrify a place. It's like, you know, spot on. That's exactly what happens here. And that's when the, you know, Asterix and Obelix and all their friends have to kind of put their plans into motion to basically scare the Romans out.
Yeah. And also just the whole part where they're trying to free the slaves and then the slaves are like, well, we're going to continue to work here, but we're going to start unions and unionizing. And then we're going to get the soldiers, the Roman soldiers, essentially to unionize and start grinding down the
pro-union, right?
Well,
we've
got that
going for us, right?
Yeah. So, you know, that's some interesting stuff that gets discussed in here as well. But I really like what you said, Rodrigo, about how you see how the local community is decimated because all of a sudden the only thing anyone wants to sell is fish and antiques. And then, you know, you can get a free antique with one batch of fish that you buy or, you know, get two fish for every antique that you buy. And it just really shows how communities can be harmed by this kind of work. So, Matthew, what did you think of this book?
Asterix et Français, il s'est choué, as far as I'm concerned, but...
Oui, c'est choué.
Oh! But here's the thing. As far as Asterix goes, I love it because you look at the art, you look, you know, anytime I see anything drawn by Uderzo, my brain just goes, oh, check it out, Jim Davis. And they're from that same kind of a Bigfoot art style. And I grew up with, you know, Mad Magazine in the 70s. So yeah. I really love looking at it. But there are, you know, Rodrigo said that there are some possibly deal-breaking issues with this one. And I feel like for me, this is definitely a Tintin in the Congo thing where I don't know. I don't feel comfortable with it because of... not just the way that the black characters are drawn. There are just moments in here where I'm like, ooh, this is very, you know, this feels kind of retrograde, even for 1971. And
Is it the section where they're reading the pamphlet about the mansions of the gods, and it feels very much like a 1950s, the husband will go to work and the wife will go to the supermarket and get to buy these things. Is that the part you're talking about? Or are you talking about the whole the whole orgies.
There's definitely
section.
That. And then, you know, the expectation. I really like the little bits where, hey, we're going to use magic acorns to redo the thing every
yes.
night.
Uh-huh.
And I like the fact that, you know, we're running around and it eventually comes down to a point where the Romans are all miserable. And I'm like, well, they're all yelling out the window at each other. Are they making a joke about Italian people? And I'm like, I mean, I watch Family Guy and cringe about a third of the time. And I just felt like throughout this book, there were moments where I kept having that quagmire feeling of I need to tune out of this episode or else part of me is just going to be like yerk the whole time. So I don't know. It's not my favorite Asterix. I think it's beautiful. It is gorgeously drawn with the exception of, you know, about 10% of the characters.
Yeah.
And any of those, you know, the wide shots, the big aerial shots of Rome, or the moments where, you know, you cut back and there's that big wide shot of the clearing in the middle of that forest, just gorgeous to look at. But it's also very much an artifact of an earlier time, and it's not a time that I necessarily feel like I can really process in a positive way and go, yeah, you definitely need to look at this. I feel like, what was the one that you and I covered a couple of years ago?
We've covered so many of them. I'm trying to think if there was. So one of the things that I'm reading here about specifically this book is that following the French riots in 68, Goscinny started to put more current political issues in France into his Asterix books. And maybe that's what's going on here, mm-hmm. is we're seeing more of that being influenced into the books as opposed to, you know, the early stuff where it was, hey, it's a tour of Italy or it is a tour of Egypt as they go and do Asterix and Obelix meet Cleopatra type stuff. So I don't know if that's what's going on here, but yeah, it did feel a lot more political and it didn't feel to me as fun as other editions that we have read. Ashley, what did you think of this overall book? I mean, you've read it since you read it in its original form.
I did. I read it in the
original language.
Yeah. Which is a very special thing to be able to do. And I say that, and I do say it with a certain air of pretension that I own, but I also do read a lot of things that are translated into other languages that I understand from languages that I don't. So it's fine however people consume all of their media, as long as it's legal. I have a soft spot for Asterix stories, for what they did in my life, for their contributions to French culture, for their contributions to the comic book realm, the same way that I do for Tintin, the same way that I do for American movies like Yankee Doodle Dandy that has a full blackface dance sequence in it. And I do think that you have to approach all art, if you choose to. It's also totally fine to choose to not engage with it, but if you choose to approach it from a certain time period and a certain perspective, going in there with your eyes open and with a little bit of grace while also being like, that's not cool. Yeah. We don't like this.
Yeah. Well, and again,
I think if I was going to recommend an Asterix collection, it would not be this one. Because the story's not the best or the most fun. I think the best Asterix has a little bit of Sergio Argonne's like spirit in there. Like it's
yes.
a little wilder. It's a little more out there than what we got here. And also racism. And that's bad, folks.
Yeah, I was trying to think of any panel in this book. You know, my favorite stuff in the Asterix books is when he punches or clobbers a Roman and all you see is their sandals.
Right.
Standing in place in the zip lines of them being punched out of the panel. I always like that stuff, but I don't remember any of that here. I'm going to go back and repeat something that I said a moment ago about the Legion Clubhouse. In when Matthew and I review these books, we look at them and say, okay, let's look at them from what was going on during the time period. What were things that were going on in the world and how did that influence the book? Also, you know, we may be talking about race relations. We may be talking about women's liberation. We may be talking about equal rights movement. We may be talking about, you know, whatever it may be. And then we say, okay, well, let's look at it from the lens of today and how that is controversial or wrong or something like that. So I think if people want to look at these books with that in mind, that this is not 2020 book. This is a book that was in 1973 when Matthew and I were but 3-year-olds or 1-year-olds, if it was first published in France. And times have changed, hopefully for the better. But I think people need to be aware of that when they go into it. Matthew, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that every time Ashley pronounces the name of the main character, it's wonderful. And I just think, tu n'as pas envie. And it just makes me so happy and so joyful to hear her speaking her second native language. But more than that, I kind of feel like I wish I could have done that. Not necessarily just read it in French, but read it in the time period in which it came out and maybe feel like I had more of a context for this story. Because I really feel like you and I did one on Dueling Review, an Asterix book a few years
ago. It was Dueling Review. I'm almost positive that it was Major Spoilers Podcast.
All right.
Yeah.
It may have been, but it was just you and me on the show. Because I think it was like, okay. And I remember that. And I really, really enjoyed that book. And I remember thinking how that book was fun and interesting. And I also swear to you that when I was a kid reading when I was reading this comic book about this main character whose name is that word, that the dog's name was Idefix. And now I'm wondering if I somehow read it in another language because the dog is now called Dogmatix. And I'm like, did I read that in another language? I don't know. But
my introduction, as I've said before, my introduction to these characters was in German. When my grandparents went to Germany in the early 70s, mid 70s, and they came back with the Cleopatra issue. And I was just like, what is this? This thing is so awesome. I can't understand a single word that they're saying, but I love looking at the pictures for hours on end. And I do remember, too, that it was like Ibelix or something like that for the dog.
Well, yeah, for anyone playing at home, the dog's name in French is Idefix. Mm-hmm. So maybe you read a translation where they didn't change the dog's name.
That's possible. I read a lot of comics where things were translated differently or poorly translated. Well, things that maybe my grandmother got a hold of when she shouldn't have.
Yeah,
that is my number one fear when I read manga. I'm like, is this a good translation?
Right.
I have you get no context. That.
With translations, you get that. And sometimes things are translated multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has the rights to, you know, back in the day, somebody had the rights to the first 10 volumes of Asterix, and then they lost them. The person that gets the rights after that might not have the rights to those original translations.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have to retranslate those first volumes as they go forward and translate the rest. So there might be multiple different translations of a book, a movie, whatever, going around. And depending on when you acquire it or from whom or whatever, you might end up with a different translation.
And
well,
I will
there's
say
always
that
the question
book
of style versus a literal translation. Like, I just watched this French movie called L'Inconnu du Lac, Stranger by the Lake, and they were definitely translating for mood because I watched it with the English subtitles. I always want to watch it with the French subtitles, but Shutter only has and subtitles. So I watched it with the English subtitles. And I was like, I wouldn't have translated it like that, but it was like a cooler way to translate it or a moodier way to translate it.
Yeah. Did you guys see that movie that was like really making the rounds there for a while, The Platform?
Mm-mm.
Freaky movie. If you want to feel bad about the human condition, definitely watch that. But there are two major aspects to that movie. One is a hole, and one is a platform that goes up and down through this hole. The original Spanish version is called The Hole, and they translated it as The Platform, which really strikes me as like an American sees the glass as half something else.
Yeah. So I will say that depending on which version of the book you're reading, there have been different English translations, different English translators. And if you go into some of the boards, they will talk about which translation is the better English translation. But I do know that in the past several years, I've read it translated by two different groups of people. So kind of keep that in mind, too.
Cool.
Currently, I know I've got a Amazon link to this volume in the show notes. If anybody wants to buy it through our Amazon link, a little bit comes back to us. Doesn't cost you anything extra. But I do know that Paper Cuts has been releasing these starting this year, I think in July, the Omnibus Collections, which are generally three volumes or three books in each one. And I believe they have it going all the way up to volume 3 as a hardcover coming out next year. So if people are really into this stuff, they can start collecting these in a soft book or hardcover edition and build them up. I was kind of hoping that Paper Cuts would release like a giant omnibus edition that collects like 12 at a time, but I guess we're not that lucky.
How many stories of Asterix are there?
There are, I want to say, 20 right now, I want to say.
Let me, 20, let me, 25, something like that?
Yes, yeah, because they just, when they did the 50th anniversary, was the golden, let's see, how many do they have? 38. Asterix and the Chieftain's Daughter came out in 2019. Now, that's not by the
Should
original
creators. Should have been the
creators.
Golden Dawn, would have been a better joke.
Yeah, they did have the, trying to think of the one that we came out in like 2000. Five? Nope. I guess it's the Chariot Race came out in 2017, so that's kind of where we're at right now. We'll get through some more of these in the future, but just realize that there's a huge change. Also, both of the creators, I believe, now are passed away, and so it's other people who are taking on the mantle of continuing these books on a yearly or every 2 years basis.
Rossini actually dies in the middle of one of the volumes in like 1977. I think Uderzo just died this year.
Yeah, it was just not too long ago when he passed. So, yeah. Okay, final thoughts, everybody. Matthew, final thoughts from you.
Asterisk is muy importante. Wait, that's not even French. Asterisk is a good book. Asterisk is a character that I would recommend that you check out, especially if you consider yourself a fan of just the form of comics and the ability to juxtapose images and words. I would not start here, and I would say that I'm sensitive enough to the issues in this book that I don't want to read it again, and I don't feel that I'm particularly sensitive. So, you know, you may want to take that into account and caveat the old mTOR.
Hey, look, there's very few times where we get classic European comics translated into English. So I really think that if you have a chance to pick up an Asterix book, definitely do so. I'm going to agree with Matthew. I'm not sure that this is a good place to start. And it's so full of just some touchy issue subjects that I'm probably going to say pass on this. Although if you're reading everything and you want to be a completist, at some point you're going to get to this. But I do think that there are other books that are better than this. Still, art is fantastic. If you're just going to pick it up for the art and then white out, get some white out and take care of all the bad spots, feel free to do that. But it's okay. This is an okay book. Rodrigo, final thoughts from you.
There are better Asterix stories than this. This one is kind of a weird one. It just kind of sits down and addresses, you know, like a real world issue that was probably, I mean, it's still very important now, but it was probably starting to be very important for the writer and the people that they cared about. But it translates into kind of a weird, kind of static comic where actually not a lot happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's my review of it, is there are better Asterix stories. Pick one of those up instead.
Yep. Ashley, we are giving you the final say this week.
There are definitely better Asterix stories. There's better Asterix movies than this. And I think if you are like a deep cut fan and you're a completist, this is a great addition, knowing the historical context and the issues that come with it. I don't know if I would recommend it necessarily. Not my fave for several many reasons that we've all gone over ad nauseum, I feel like. But I did not have the worst time. Like, we've read things that I had a tougher time getting through for the podcast.
Yeah. And that's the dernier mot.
Yep.
Wait, say so.
All right, everybody. Thank you. Ashley, where can people find more of your stuff?
Oh, baby, baby, baby. If you backed your project, The Forgotten Radio, then that is going to be throttling its way into your post boxes in the next couple days. Unless you're international, sorry about it. Don't control the international post. Godspeed with that. Please let me know when it arrives and if it arrives in one piece. If you are not a Kickstarter backer, then you can get Jupiter Jet and The Forgotten Radio on Amazon. You can get signed copies from Collector's Paradise on their website. In a couple weeks when we're done with the Kickstarter, you can get them directly from jcinnamon.com/store. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ashley V. Robinson. Please send me pictures of cute animals and cute boys and girls, because I'm dying and I can't see anymore. And I'm rewatching Chorus, so we'll see if I continue to be at loggerheads with everyone else on this podcast about that series when I complete it in a couple weeks.
All right, Matthew, where can people find you?
You can find me kicking, jumping, doing my thing at Mighty King Cobra, currently in the midst of the week-long celebration of 6 years of 10 things, woo! Which really kind of freaks me out because I don't get paid and seven people listen, but dang it, I do it out of love. So come find me, have fun, throw things at me, show me prettier girls than you show Ashley, and then give her all the pretty boys and we'll call it even.
And Rodrigo, where can people find you?
You can find me at Fearsome Critter, and definitely do not send me anyone pretty. I don't want it. So yes, if you're into this sort of exciting repartee, definitely find me there.
All right, that wraps it up for the Shoo. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers experience.
As always, nous aimons vos feedback. Use the comments section at Major Spoilers to share your thoughts and reactions to this and every episode.
Ou plus bien, envoyez-nous un électronique message à podcast@majorspoilers.com.
Of course, feedback in French is manger derrière. Don't forget, you can support this show. No, don't put that into Google Translate. You can support this show and everything we do by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
We will be back next week because we know that you love comics. We do too. We will talk with you soon.
Fat the X-ray vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, he kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven, it's like a man of iron. Might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. Would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun bee in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2020 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.